Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 413.
This week on the podcast, having COVID has given Alan West too much free time. Let's get that man out of the hospital ASAP.
And the debt ceiling. It's a problem we invented just so we could solve it.
Plus infrastructure. It never ends. It also never starts.
And it's fake panic time for the fake jobs numbers.
Plus, with schools finally open, it's time to get back to the business of studying duck and cover techniques. The only true way to prepare kids for the American workplace.
And it's the return of Sinkhole Radio.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com. Welcome to another week of a little bit of stress pulling the news, because all of the talk this week has been just debt ceiling and some vague infrastructure updates. And we have no real progress to report on either front that's meaningful in any long-term sense.
Right.
With that said, we are expecting some kind of FDA announcement about the Pfizer vaccine for people age 5 to 10.
Yeah.
So that's exciting, because maybe little kids can stop being disease vectors.
Well, this won't stop that generally,
right.
Anyway.
No.
Right?
Just this still, one kind of disease vector.
You still don't want to be around children.
That's right.
Of this age most times.
Right. If you have any concern for your own health.
That's right.
But
you're still going to get a cold from that.
Yes. But at least it will maybe just be a cold that won't murder you.
That's right. That's it. Yeah.
And speaking of COVID, Alan West just announced that he's tested positive for COVID. He also infected his wife, who was vaccinated.
Right. Yeah, speaking of murder.
Yeah, I mean. Exactly. Alan West, who is a person who is currently in the hospital and using that free time to go on anti-vax tirades from his hospital
on
bed.
Twitter.
Well,
it's like you said, too.
Classic.
You're like, didn't he know that, like, the thing that you do as a Republican is you go on anti-vax tirades, but then you secretly get the vaccine.
Yes.
Right?
Did no one tell him that we were all secretly getting it?
Like Donald Trump, a man who was vaccinated.
Yes.
Right?
Everyone knows.
Greg Abbott, a man who was vaccinated.
Vaccinated 100 times, as far as I can tell. Greg Abbott's been vaccinated more times than anyone else in America. These are all people that don't, quote unquote, believe in the science. However,
they're still doing their own research.
They're doing their own research, and the research that they're doing privately is very different than the research they've been doing publicly. And their private research has led them to get the vaccine because they're not fucking idiots.
Right. They're not trying to kill their wives.
No.
Certainly.
They're evil, right. But they're not idiots. Right. Alan West, a man I now consider an
evil idiot.
Is an evil idiot.
Yeah. Which, surprise.
I mean, we knew. But it's also like, just, why wasn't he on the phone tree? I just feel like somebody like a Newt Gingrich type couldn't have called him and been like, hey, friend, we're getting the vaccine.
Right.
Don't listen to what I'm saying in public.
Everybody at Fox News has been vaccinated.
Yes. Right. Sean Hannity could have called him up and let him know that that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
Like,
poor guy.
It's like no one cared about Alan West enough to keep him in the loop.
Nope.
So that's sad for him.
It is.
And then.
And his wife.
And his wife. Who was vaccinated and also had to get antibody treatment in the hospital because she was still very sick.
Yeah.
Because you don't need to go and get the monoclonal antibody treatment unless you are very sick.
Yeah.
No one is like...
Yeah, Alan West, I think,
in his
first Twitter post said that he was like feeling okay, but his blood oxygen level was way lower than it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, and he's in the hospital. He's a man who's in the hospital right now.
Yeah.
And I know these fools get to go to the hospital at the drop of a hat because for some reason they have health insurance when the rest of us don't. But still... we also had a little bit of drama in Texas where we thought for a moment there was a temporary injunction about SB 8, the restrictive abortion law, the vigilante justice abortion law in Texas. But then within 24 hours, Texas appealed and the injunction disappeared and now the law's back in effect.
You had a 24-hour window to
help someone get an abortion in Texas.
Get an abortion in Texas.
No, you can get an abortion in Texas.
Oh, yeah, right.
You can't help someone get an abortion in Texas. Yeah, yeah. You had 24 hours to assist somebody else in getting an abortion in Texas, but that is now gone.
Oh, God, guys.
But just FYI to everyone, you are still entitled as a non-Texan to help a Texan get an abortion because you are not in Texas.
Oh, yeah, right.
So if you need to help a Texan get an abortion not in Texas, no one can really do anything about that.
Yeah, yeah.
So you are still empowered as a non-voter in Texas to help Texans get all the abortions you want.
Yeah.
It's just that Texans aren't empowered to help themselves help themselves.
Right.
And that's too bad.
It is.
In any case, let's talk about the debt ceiling.
Oh, my Lord.
I want to start with something that Brent told me today that is not something I knew, which kind of blows my mind.
Yeah.
Which is, so as some background, the Senate was supposed to vote on Wednesday on a Democratic bill that was going to lift the debt ceiling through 2022. That bill was going to be blocked by Republicans.
Right.
And so everyone was like, that's going to go nowhere.
The hilarious thing about that is that the Republican line on this has been that the Democrats, that the Republicans aren't going to help. So the Democrats have to do it by themselves.
Right.
Which all Democrats are like, well, fine, because we have 51 votes here.
Exactly. And, like, also, this is, like, a bizarre line to have because it, like, implies that, yes, this does need to be done. We're just not going to help.
I know.
Like,
exactly.
That's not governing.
No,
in any
it's
case.
Not.
So suddenly, at some point on Thursday, Mitch McConnell is suddenly willing to play ball to, he was initially telling them that they had to pass it via reconciliation. And then suddenly he was like, we'll do a temporary extension till December and then you have to use reconciliation. Who knows why? And so my question to Brent, to everyone, to America was, why are we talking about reconciliation at all? If it's that easy, why aren't they just doing it?
Yep.
And Brent told me a thing that I didn't know, that I feel embarrassed that I didn't know, but you probably didn't know either, listener. And now you'll know. And now we'll all know together. Which is that no one ever leads these articles with the main reason that they don't want to use reconciliation to pass this. It's not about looking like it's a unilateral thing. What do they care? Their voters want the debt ceiling raised.
Yeah.
There's no downside electorally to them single-handedly raising the debt ceiling. The reason they don't want to do it is they're only allowed to pass 3 reconciliation bills a year, and Mitch McConnell is trying to use this to eat up one of those attempts.
Yeah.
So, you know, when they have all of these big plans to address infrastructure and address whatever, the reason they're trying to, like, put them all into tiny little bills and then tell them that they have to pass those tiny bills via reconciliation is it basically his attempt to, like, run out the clock on their ability to do this. And so him claiming that in December, you know, they're going to have to use reconciliation is him sort of threatening to use up one of the few chances they have to actually pass some legislation.
Yeah. And supposedly the reason that he actually bit on this, because Republicans were pissed. His own party was mad. Ted Cruz was mad. Lindsey Graham was mad because, like,
God forbid Ted Cruz be mad at you.
I know. He had supposedly drawn a real line in the sand that he was not going to strike a deal here and he was not going to help the Democrats on this. And help them, air quotes.
Right,
help them. And there were a lot of reports coming out that the reason that he had done so was because he was afraid that the Democrats were going to use the nuclear option and they were going to change the filibuster rules specifically for the debt ceiling, which is hilarious that they would have done that, but have been really digging in their heels on doing so. Even Joe Biden won't do it to pass a voting rights legislation.
He won't do it to do anything that actually helps the American people, but they will consider getting rid of the filibuster in a man-made crisis in which they have created a policy that they then have to continually resolve.
When what they really could have gotten rid of
is the debt ceiling.
Is the actual debt ceiling.
Right. Use the reconciliation bill to get rid of the idea of a debt ceiling.
Exactly. Oh, man.
So then they argue for a while because the main negotiation points are about whether to raise it through a date or through a number, which is a fake and arbitrary thing to worry about. But it's also, they did it with a number and they always do this. And the thing about doing it through a number, raising it to a certain number, is that no one then knows when we're going to reach it.
Oh, yeah.
It becomes like a mysterious, like, thing hanging over your head, but you don't have any idea when the hammer's going to fall.
Yeah.
So they just basically created, like, a false, I think they did this specifically to avoid having a date so that they could fudge it a bit, is my theory. But, because this is the thing. The Republicans, like the Democrats, know that we need to raise the debt ceiling.
Of course.
They know that. The reason they're doing this is just to be obstructive. There's a reason we didn't go through this kind of strife when Trump was the president.
Yeah.
And it's because they didn't want to make it look like it was their fault that we didn't raise the debt ceiling.
Well, and you use it. Look, I mean, one thing that the Democrats are bad about, except maybe the progressives now, that they have an actual caucus, is that the Democrats are bad at sort of, like, using power in the ways that the Republicans are. Because, like, what they're using this for is, they're using it for leverage, right?
Right.
Like, I mean, they know that it needs to be raised, but they also, like, you saw Susan Collins hilariously be like, well, we'd be willing to raise it if they would be willing to get rid of their $3.5 trillion human infrastructure plan,
like,
which was hilarious because, like, they're not going to do that. Like, even Joe Manchin doesn't want to get rid of that. Like,
no.
We're going to talk about some of his ridiculous wants and needs coming up in a future story. But, like, you know, so it's not going to work for them, I don't think. And I think rightly this always ends up getting blamed on the Republicans, which is another reason why I'm like, have they learned no lessons from previous debt ceiling battles? They have been blamed publicly for this every single time it's happened, mainly because it has always been their fault.
I was going to say,
but, like,
the
I think that they think that, like, maybe they'll be able to, like, convince the American people that since the Democrats, like, technically have every branch of government, that it's their fault. But it's like, no, I think Americans, while maybe not total geniuses, like, are savvy enough to know that you now have to have 60 votes to pass anything in the Senate.
Yeah,
because
at this point,
they're all as frustrated about it as everybody else
is. Exactly.
So, like, I just don't think that this is gonna. I don't think that this is gonna work for him.
No,
well, like in the long run, like
the kind of thing that is also very openly just about being difficult because everyone knows we have to do it. So there's not really a version of this that's like, let's reconsider what the debt ceiling means and is.
Yeah.
If we were talking about, is this the time to get rid of the debt ceiling or not? That's a sort of philosophical conversation about what this policy actually means. But he's not arguing to get rid of the debt ceiling. Like what they're arguing is to have everything fall apart.
Yeah, that's it.
Like their position here is chaos.
Yeah.
So like, and also in extending the debt ceiling, they also extended government funding just through December. So now in early December, we're going to have a government shutdown probably caused by Republicans that they're going to think they're blaming on Democrats. And here's the thing. I think to some degree that will work because I think when it comes to government shutdowns, people get to the point where they're like, I am so frustrated that I actually just need an adult in the room to solve this. And why can't the Democrats be that adult, especially considering that they do have, you know, 51 votes in the Senate? Like, I think that he has some strong leverage with that just in terms of messaging, because you know they'll fuck up the messaging. It'd be one thing if we could trust the Democrats to do any reasonable messaging, but we can't. So you know that they'll fuck that up. Much like we were talking about earlier, how Brent finally saw some actual proof in polls that no one has any fucking idea what's in the infrastructure.
Oh yeah, last week we talked about like how bad the Democrats' messaging had been on that $3.5 trillion bill, and then lo and behold, there was a poll that came out. It was, I think, CBS News poll that said Americans are much more likely to know what the price tag is than what's in that actual bill. And I was like,
that's Republican messaging, my friends. That's the Overton window shifting right.
Yeah.
If we're just talking about the price tag and we're not talking about what we're getting for it, we're not talking about policy.
Yeah.
But so I think this
that's
is
because the Democrats haven't.
Well, exactly. That's a messaging fail.
Anyway, that's a messaging
and
fail.
And that's a similar thing to what I suspect we'll see with the government funding thing, the government shutdown thing, where they will just fail to effectively message why they can't do anything about it. So they'll just look helpless and it'll look weird because they're in charge of everything. And so they shouldn't be this helpless.
Yeah.
So I think McConnell is probably onto something with pushing both of those to one date where he can kind of couch the debt ceiling conversation in a government funding conversation. I wish that I believed we were smart enough to out-message him on that because it would be easy.
Well, and he definitely claims that he's not going to be helping us when December rolls around, because after this passed on, I think it was Thursday, I don't know, maybe it was Friday, but like Chuck Schumer took to the Senate floor and like really dragged Mitch McConnell and the Republicans and said that they were playing a dangerous and risky partisan game and like really kind of like went on a tirade. And like the Republicans were like big mad about that. Joe Manchin was mad about it. Like, just because
their feelings are so tender.
He wants civility, wants everybody to just be nice to each other. Actually, Joe Manchin was behind Chuck Schumer during this, and there's like some ridiculous pictures of him with like his head in his hand as if like the world is ending, but really all it is Chuck Schumer just saying that Mitch McConnell
pointing out that Mitch McConnell was playing a dangerous partisan game.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. But immediately after that happened, he wrote a letter to Joe Biden, which he probably had written whether that Schumer was going to make this speech
for sure
at all. But he said that Schumer played was being childish and that he poisoned the well. And he said that Republicans, quote, filled the leadership vacuum that has troubled the Senate since January. I will not provide such assistance again if your all Democratic government drifts into another avoidable crisis. Yes. So he's not here to help any longer.
No. Well,
I mean, barely was anyway.
I was going to say he wasn't here to help at the beginning. Yeah. So certainly this is not a shocking turn of events.
Yeah.
But I do wonder what the backroom conversations between Manchin and McConnell have been of late. Because I know that Sinema has been having backroom conversations with McConnell because we've seen that happen on the floor before.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a little bit of a sneak. Because this is like, we have to remember when we watch these headlines come in, when we see these kind of quotes, their whole intention is to be childish and play a risky partisan game and then act incensed that they got called on their literal behavior.
Totally.
So we can't be mad that we can't be mad that this happened because we knew that this was their strategy always, but we also can't listen to either side of that conversation.
No.
Both of them are failing at messaging as far as I'm convinced.
Totally.
The Democrats should absolutely be talking about what the American people get and don't get from these conversations.
Yeah.
The Republicans then look petty when they're talking about their feelings because their feelings have nothing to do with what's actually substantially important to American people.
Right.
But the Democrats instead start you know, name calling themselves, and then the Republicans get their feelings hurt, even though they're such assholes. I don't know how they could possibly have, you know, be claiming that this is something that they couldn't, they're not strong enough to handle being called childish partisan assholes, but whatever. But that's their whole intention in being difficult, is to be called difficult, so that we can then call them difficult. And then they'll be like, you called me difficult. That's not fair. So like, this is all theater and nonsense.
Yeah, that's true.
But also, here are some thoughts. A, just abolish the fucking debt ceiling.
I mean,
everyone knows that's a better idea than any of this.
Thankfully, there's like some movement in that direction. Yeah. There is a new... So there's been this... what's the name? Brendan Doyle, who's in the House from Pennsylvania, has released bills before to just completely abolish it. And they've not really ever gone anywhere because people love to sort of like use this as a, you know... Yeah.
They love having this.
It's a power grab, essentially, right? So anyway, but now there's like this new push to... keep the debt ceiling because God knows why. But anyway, but it's a better idea because they want to move the power to raise it from Congress and give it to the Treasury Secretary.
Yes.
So Janet Yellen, who is the current Treasury Secretary, is in favor of this.
Well, she would be.
Right, exactly. She would be. And also now the Budget Committee Chairman, John Yarmuth, has also signed on to it as well. Yeah. And Pelosi was asked about it this week, and she said that she also thought it was a great idea, and then went on to yammer on about how her focus right now is to, you know, stave off the one that's coming in December, which I actually kind of get, because they're not going to get this law passed prior to December, obviously. So, like, I'm going to allow her that. So there's also, and for any corporate Democrats who are concerned about whether that's a thing that they their people would want them to do or not, Jamie Dimon...
He agrees with us.
Because nobody in nobody in the financial sector wants the economy to
be reeling around this way. This is very unstable.
Yeah.
And it's fake. Yeah. This is a problem we invented.
Other countries don't do this.
No.
By the way.
No, this is just like a fake thing we made up so that we could have these crises, so that people could make power grabs in these crises.
Other countries
no one
just
needs this.
Carry on paying their bills as if that's what you're supposed to do.
I also feel like, to me, what rubs me the wrong way about this whole conversation is, you know, we pay taxes to pay salaries of people to go to Congress and ostensibly do the work of the people. And this is not the work of anyone. It's like they set a job up for themselves and then they only do that job, and they are not doing the other job we hired them to do because they're so busy. It's like this is wasting taxpayer dollars.
It certainly is.
I don't know why Republicans think that services that actually help people are wasting taxpayer dollars to the extent that they do. But this is wasting taxpayer dollars.
Yeah.
I want these people to spend their 8 hours a day that they are working. I don't know if they work 8 hours a day, hours a day, 14 hours a day. I have no idea. But I want them to spend their 8 hours doing the work of the American people. And this is not even in the ballpark of the work of the American people.
No.
This is as if you build a brick wall every morning and then you're like, my job today is to get tear down this wall so I can get to the office. Like, that's not, just don't build the wall.
I know. Yeah, exactly.
In any case, the other thing that I have to say about it is I would... like if maybe we could have a serious conversation about abolishing the filibuster, not via specific issues that don't help anybody.
I know.
But just like, abolish it.
Yes.
Just do it.
Right.
Don't, this is, you've been given an opening.
Right.
You've been given a chance.
Yeah.
Don't.
Let's set some precedents.
Let's set some precedents. Let's change things.
Let's change.
Because the thing that I don't like about, I don't like the idea of moving this to the budget committee, to the, Secretary of the Treasury, because there are Republican Treasury secretaries.
Well, that's what I was going
to
say. Yeah, there's...
So this is just continuing to allow this to be a dumb problem.
Yeah. There's one coming in 2024 if the Democrats don't pass something.
Right, exactly. So, like, I don't know if we... If we necessarily want to, like, it's like they won't play a gamble with their own power, but they're like, we'll gamble on 2024.
I think the point, though, of that is that even a Republican Treasury Secretary would very obviously raise the debt ceiling.
Yes.
Right? Because they're not going
to
send the country reeling on their own. Right, exactly. Yeah. Because Republicans in Congress raise the debt ceiling all the time when they're in power. So,
exactly.
Like, everybody gets that you have to keep raising the debt ceiling. I mean, nobody's delusional about it. They're just delusional about, you know, the gamesmanship of getting it done.
In any case.
Oh, boy.
Latest on infrastructure. Joe Manchin also being a pill in that arena.
Yeah. So... I feel like one of the things that I sort of like just learned while we were trying to like dig into where we were on the infrastructure bill here. We know that last week Manchin said that his new price tag was $1.5 trillion, right? And supposedly at the beginning of the week, Biden told, I think Pelosi and the Progressive Caucus that it was going to have to be somewhere between like $1.9 and $2.2 trillion. So they're still trying to figure out what they're going to put in it, what the actual price tag is. The progressives are still mad at Manchin and Sinema just because they still are acting like they don't know what they want in it. I think most of that ire has been starting to head toward Sinema's side, yeah. which I'm fine
well,
with.
Well, she truly doesn't know. She's just being a pill.
Right. Like, Manchin is actually, like giving a number and saying what things that he wants to cut, or, like, giving progressives, telling them that they have to cut one of three things right. or whatever. I mean, like, so, like, he's at least, like, come to the table. I mean, I...
Right, in bad faith, but he's got
right,
ideas.
In bad faith, right, yeah, exactly. So, but I was wondering, like, you know, they're fighting over this price tag so much, which I get, because, like, you're going to have to pay for these things, and they are trying to make it all paid for, so they're trying to figure out, like, you know, how much to raise taxes and what the where they're going to find the pay-fors or whatever. And, like, I think we finally figured out this week why Manchin is so attached to the $1.5 trillion, and it's not because he actually gives a shit about what ends up in the thing.
Of course not.
Right? What he's worried about is what the taxes are going to look like to get to the $1.5 trillion. And apparently, like, he has already put forward a tax plan that has a lot of crossover with a tax framework that has already come out of the House Ways and Means Committee. And that gets you to $1.5 trillion without that much pain for his rich friends.
Right.
Right? So that's really why he's at 1.5 here. Because what... we'll just give you the numbers, I think, here. There, he wants to raise the corporate tax rate to 25%. I think it's at 21 right now. That would get you $400 billion. The Ways and Means has it at 26.5, so those are pretty close. That would get you $540 billion. The both Manchin and the Ways and Means want to hike the capital gains rate to 25%, which is another $125 billion. They want to restore the top marginal tax rate to 36.9%, which is basically...
39.6%.
Or 39.6, sorry, which is pre... the Trump 2017 tax cuts, that's $170 billion. Improving tax compliance, just getting people to pay their actual taxes, can get you...
This, by the way, is them preying on poor people. If you're wondering what that money is, it's not so that they can get Jeff Bezos to pay one single dollar in taxes. It's so that they can audit you, a random person who doesn't have the tools to do your taxes correctly, and then make you pay more money because you didn't realize you owed more money.
You can get $200 billion that way. There's also a rule to tighten the tax rate on multinational companies' overseas earnings, which supposedly would get you $300 billion. There's another one extending a rule that Democrats already approved that makes it harder for owners of pass-through businesses to use losses to offset income. And that would supposedly get you $167 billion. There's some so-called dynamic scoring, which is where you can say that you're paying through things by just, like, savings of things that are, like, in the bill, essentially. So with all of those things, which are pretty minimal, I mean, like, a 4% tax increase, you're only up to, or, like, on the, you know, the corporate tax increase, that's only, like, you know, it was 28% under freaking George W. Or, no, it was 35,
wasn't it? It was
35,
I think, 35%.
So, like, going up to 25, these are all things that are sort of, like, small lifts, and that gets you over $1.5 trillion. So, like, what he's trying to do is he's trying to pass this thing without having to do some of the more aggressive pay-fors, which is what the left wants to do, like taxing stock buybacks and for corporations, treating billionaires' unrealized capital gains as taxable income. That's a huge one, right?
Huge
because,
one.
Like, Jeff Bezos is not reporting his $200 billion or however much it is as income earned, right?
Exactly.
So that's not being taxed as income, and Democrats would like it to. So, but of course, Joe Manchin doesn't want it to be.
Because
why would he, right? And then there's also, the left has been trying to...
it's inheritance tax
right,
stuff.
Right, get rid of some of the inheritance tax stuff. Yeah, so...
Sure. Beef up some of the...
Right, excuse me, yes. So he's just trying to avoid all of those things. That's all he's concerned about. He doesn't give a shit what's in the thing.
No.
And that's why he's... telling the progressives to pick. I mean, he literally doesn't care. Like, I think this week he was like, you have to pick one of these three things. He doesn't actually have an opinion on what's in the thing. He just knows that he doesn't want to tax billionaires' unrealized capital gains as taxable income.
That's
all he knows.
Yeah.
He doesn't care about the child tax credit.
He doesn't care if his constituents need help paying for childcare.
No, he doesn't give a shit.
Or whether that even counts as infrastructure in his mind.
Yeah.
He cares about Jeff Bezos being a person who doesn't have to report most of his income as taxable.
That's right. And that's also what Kyrsten Sinema cares about as well.
She cares about it. She doesn't know enough about the details, it seems, to know what about it she cares about is a problem. Because she's not even giving them a framework to work from.
No.
She's just like out here having a broken foot and going to fundraisers. And that's like all that anyone knows about what she's up to.
Ugh.
But yeah, I feel like the three things that Joe Manchin wanted progressives to pick between were an expanded child tax credit, paid family medical leave, and subsidies for childcare.
Yeah.
The three things that would most directly benefit regular people.
Right. And
West Virginians potentially is so fascinating to me that this is like a comfortable place for him to be. Like the only person who is currently naming things that are in the bill is the man who is telling us we have to pick one and cut the rest.
I know.
So the only reason I know that those things are in the bill is because Joe Manchin wants us to cut two of them.
Yeah. And I think this is another interesting fight that you're going to see play out as they try and come to some sort of agreement on this. And this will be, I think, become probably more public here. But like there's now two different camps on what to put in here, because Manchin and the moderates are trying to put less in here and then claim that they're fully funding it. So that's going to be how they try and convince you that they are actually doing the people's work here, is that they're fully funding things. The progressives
don't fall for that bullshit.
Right, because what the progressives are going to do, they think to themselves, okay, if we're only going to get $1.9 trillion, then let's put every single thing in here and let's just fund it for like 2 years instead of 5 years.
Yeah.
Because once we do some of these things, then it will become very hard to undo them because they will be things that everyone loves.
Exactly.
And so that is what Joe Manchin is now fighting against. He's fighting against the reason that he only wants one of these things in here is because he knows that if you put all three of them in there and only fund them for a brief amount of time, there will come a time where you will have to refund them because everyone will continue to want them.
This is, I think, what's so frustrating about the way that sort of Democrats since the New Democrat era have approached policymaking, which is, I think if you know that you only get 4 years guaranteed in there to like get in there and do some shit, I feel like give people everything that you want them to have and then let them be the driving force of continuing those programs. Well, and these Democrats couch their unwillingness to do that in language about fiscal responsibility that's complete bullshit.
Yeah.
Because it is not actually their responsibility to sort of manage these programs 10 years into the future. It's their responsibility to help their constituents right now and assume that if their constituents want to keep the privileges that they have based on the things that they're getting, then they will continue to vote for people who support refunding those programs. Like, I think that the sort of Clintons get really deep in the weeds of, and this is part of their sort of like incrementalist approach to policy, where they get really deep in the weeds of like making sure policy is sustainable and whatever. And like, these programs get broken apart anyway.
Oh,
it doesn't matter how well you plan.
Yeah.
Everything falls off a cliff at some point anyway. Everything has to be reconsidered.
Yeah.
It turns out things you thought were brilliant turn out to be not brilliant.
Yeah, the 94
crime bill turns out to be not brilliant. Welfare reform in 96 turns out to be not brilliant. These are all things that were meant to keep these programs sustainable for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And like, fuck off with that.
Yeah.
Because what would have been better than reforming welfare in 96 to quote unquote keep it sustainable for the future would have been having welfare post 96 for anyone.
I know.
Like, we don't have to agree that that's our approach. I think a lot of Democrats get really drawn into these talking points about fiscal responsibility and about how we're the party. Good government and blah, blah, blah. And like, don't let anyone convince you that this is better government than a government that actually takes care of people. It's not.
Exactly. Well, and I think that this is going to be hard. The progressives will win the messaging on this also.
Yeah.
So like, I think that if the moderates think that like it's a win for them to go out to the American people and be like, look,
you can only have one of these three things you need.
You're not going to get a child tax credit or paid family leave, but we're going to fully subsidize your child care.
Right.
And then you have the progressives go out and be like, look, we're going to give you a child tax credit, paid family leave, and subsidies for child care. Maybe you'll only get them for 2 years before we have to come back and re-up them. Like, everybody is going to be like, well, we would like all three of those for maybe 2 or 3 years
also,
and then just give them to us again in 3 years.
Nobody has enough money to care about what happens 10 years in the future. I think that's another thing. When you're dealing with a population that is facing a time of great uncertainty, there is no, I don't fucking care what the policy is supposed to be 10 years from now.
I don't even know
if we're going to be here in 10 years. Climate change might take us anyway. People are not really in a mood right now where you can promise them a stable future. And so pretending Like, that's what we're doing here.
I feel like
is insane.
I feel like people would take those three things for 1 month.
If versus, they were being offered.
Versus one of them funded for a decade. 10 years.
Yes, I know.
Right?
Literally, nobody has any sense of what, like, 1 year from now is going to look like. And that complicates your messaging. And that is very different than the environment that these people sort of formulated this new Democrats Clintonian strategy in. Because in the 90s, people saw a future for themselves. And right now, post 9/11, post COVID, they do not. So you can't message to people as if they care about what happens to them 10 years from now.
Because they just need you're not now.
When you're not willing to take action to guarantee that we have 10 years is another thing. So, like, this is a bullshit message anyway. Because if they were going to say, we're going to fund this program for 10 years and we're going to address these climate change initiatives so that we have 10 years, people might be like, oh, okay, great. But right now, that's not what they're saying. What they're saying is we're going to do nothing to address the fact that the world is falling into a chaotic hell. Instead, we're going to give you less stuff right now because we know you'll need it for 10 years. You know what people don't need for 10 years? A child tax credit.
Right. They
Kids grow up.
Right. Yeah.
They need it now. They need these things now because their kids are young now.
Yeah.
They need childcare now.
Yeah.
You know? And at a certain point, they don't need childcare anymore. And you've just fucked up their lives. So, like, I'm hoping not going to be a huge messaging flop for Democrats. But when they get into this conversation really irks me because I think there is a certain kind of sort of like middle class educated bureaucrat that really is drawn to this kind of responsibility argument.
Totally.
And this is just like not the time to make it. It will not resonate with any young person. It will not resonate with any middle class person because no one's middle class anymore. We're all just struggling. Like, There is only this very specific sector of technocrats that this resonates with.
Yeah.
And no one else.
Yeah.
And like, because of that, that's how you lose an election.
Totally.
Is by failing, is by condescending to everyone about how they need 10 years of child, you know, of one priority when they actually need 2 years of three priorities to get them through this next period while we recover from this crisis.
Yeah.
In any case, it's stupidity. It's stupid.
Completely.
Yeah. And it's not in good faith. Because the people that are driving this argument are not people who want you to have things.
That's what I was going to say. The only reason that they're doing this is because they know.
They want it to be cheaper. It's cheaper.
They want it to be cheaper, but also they know if they give it to you for 2 years, then they're going to be stuck giving it to you for another 10.
Because
you will like it.
At the
time. They don't want you to. That's why Joe Manchin this week said that he didn't want America to turn into an entitlement society.
That's right. You know what I want is us to be the most entitlement of societies.
Right. Well, and Joe Manchin is... nobody's more entitled in this country than corporations and rich people.
Right?
He
is working for the most entitled of the entitled in the U.S. government.
Yeah.
But this is something, and this is by the way, how they, this is something that came up when I first started doing advocacy work around the 9/11 health program. The thing that we kept getting told over and over was, you can't talk about the broad implications of this because nobody is going to pass an entitlement program for this because no one wants that to be a precedent that we set because then other people will ask for an entitlement program. So we have to frame it as if this is the most exceptional and special thing that has ever happened and that you are the most exceptional and special people that have ever graced the earth because otherwise people will think that there's that they can also access this kind of entitlement program. And I was like, yeah, they should fucking get an entitlement.
Right.
People who go through similar crises should have an entitlement program.
Yeah.
We should be entitled to something.
Yeah.
Why is that crazy to say?
I know.
But like that's like the operating principle of Washington is like, let's not do anything that creates an entitlement program or an entitlement policy. So all of these people are living in a world where they have like a mental block on entitlement programs.
Yeah.
And they also think that when voters hear that these are entitlement programs, that they'll be like, no, not entitlement programs. But voters don't fucking care about that.
No.
Republicans are going to go out there and being like, they want to create all these entitlement programs. And people are going to be like, good.
Yeah.
I need one.
I know. And for too long, the Democrats have been like, oh, no, we're not doing that. The response from Democrats should be like, yes, we did. And that entitlement program
entitles you.
That he's talking about is free childcare for you. Would you like that?
Would you like to be entitled to that?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the messaging.
No, but Democrats don't do that.
I know.
Yeah.
But this is a very sort of, they're locked into this weird like Clinton era mindset about it. This is a very Clintonian problem.
Yeah.
The way that we even discuss the issues that we're theoretically making policy for is in a it's in a right wing frame.
Yeah.
You know, so that
yeah.
that we're talking about the wrong problem right now.
Yeah.
In any case, you might have seen that there was a jobs report that people weren't thrilled about. And this is, I think, where we come in to remind you that all jobs numbers right. are fake.
I wasn't thrilled about it either. But the thing that I wasn't thrilled about was that I had to read them.
There's nothing I like less than hearing about numbers. And there's certainly nothing I like less than hearing about numbers that are definitely going to be revised.
Yeah.
And that is the case with these numbers and is the case with all numbers. So we had a disappointing jobs report in August, and we now have had a disappointing jobs report in September. Mm-hmm. There's a possibility that they will be revised dramatically because the survey ended mid-September, which is about the time that Delta was plateauing.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's a chance that the second half of the month will be a lot more active. Booster started happening. Stuff was going on. So August got revised higher, but not high enough to make it worth any of our whiles. But here's the thing. These numbers aren't indicating anything.
Right.
So I don't know what to tell you about this other than that you probably shouldn't read the jobs report.
I agree. Yeah.
Like, and also the things that sound good in it are bad too. Like when unemployment falls, I'm always like, there's always some catch with unemployment falling. I know,
right.
It's like it fell, but everyone is making $6 an hour and working 17 jobs.
Right, exactly.
And there's this ongoing crisis of people not being able to find workers.
Yeah.
And that being framed as if Americans have gotten lazy during the pandemic. But what's actually happening is that jobs are not paying living wages.
I know. Well, and I'll be curious to see, because if this only went through mid-September, I'll be curious to see what happened in the second half of the month, only because of my prediction months ago that people would start hiring more after September, because it was the September 4th when the federal unemployment insurance ended.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to have then is a low unemployment rate and no one able to afford food.
And not because people were deciding not to go back to work because they were making more on unemployment. I don't want you to think that that's what I meant.
No.
What I mean is that I think that employers had been holding off on hiring because they were waiting until people were off of that so they could go back to basically lower wages. Nickel and diming them and paying them at the shit wages that they were already paying them prior to people being on the unemployment.
Yeah. Yeah, it's easier to exploit people who have no other options.
That's right. Yes, exactly.
Meanwhile, so we've been seeing a lot of inflation in 2021 as well, and there's been some consternation about that, but there was an interesting article in the Times today about the sort of shadow inflation, the other ways in which companies are cutting back on things that can't be measured numerically as easily. And that's something I wanted to talk about only because I've been talking so much about the time tax now that I have this word for it.
Sure.
And this is something I think that is related to that. So you might have noticed that like a lot of service-based things that you might be purchasing come with less service than they used to. So like hotel rooms don't get cleaned as often. Restaurants, staffs are very, you know, stretched very thin. You can't find a car anywhere. You can't, like there's all of these ways in which people are being asked to fill in service gaps that normally were included with the price of certain services. And I think that that's something that's related to this, you know, this idea that I've been going on about that Americans accept, you know, a far greater time tax on almost every service than anyone else in the world. And I was thinking about that a lot because I was on a very troubling Amtrak ride recently.
Oh my God, yes.
You know, it took me 10 hours to get from DC to New York. We were stuck between stations in a pandemic in a crowded train for, you know, 6 of those hours.
Yeah.
And I, you know, they made an announcement on the train that we should call Amtrak the next day to customer service because they were going to give us something. They didn't say what it was. I spent all day trying to reach Amtrak. True. I was on hold for hours.
Yep.
When I finally reached them, all they were offering was a fucking refund on the price, which is like, no, because there were crew mismanagements as well. They didn't have enough. The crew timed out twice on that during that ride. So 4 hours of the delay were us waiting for new crews multiple times. Got like it. Things like that kept happening. They released us at Penn Station with no transport options at 4 in the morning on a Sunday night and like didn't give any sort of guidance about how we should get home from there.
Yeah.
These were all things that became my responsibility to take on.
Yep.
You know, the time of calling Amtrak, why didn't they just automatically give me a refund, for example? Yep. Why was I asked to call them in the first place and explain the problem? Why was it my responsibility to find my way home after that kind of an incident? Why did we wait for 2 separate recrews? That wasted hours of my time and that was their mismanagement, not mine.
Right.
These are all things that I feel like are actually costs to the customer. They are a form of inflation on the cost of whatever you purchase.
Yeah.
And we accept a lot of them with no question because we're so used to this happening. We're so used to the fact that in order to get any decent service from a large corporation, you have to like take to Twitter and you have to call them and you have to wait on hold and you have to talk to 17 different people. I remember I had an issue with Spectrum, Time Warner Cable, we remember you. But I had an issue with Spectrum last year where it took me hours of my life to sort out. Yeah, didn't you report them to the FCC? I reported them to the FCC. By the way, report them to the FCC if you have an issue with them. It got resolved immediately as soon as I did that. But it took me hours of work to do that. And why was my time not worth anything in that interaction? You know, if you've ever dealt with a health insurance company, you know that a lot of the work gets done by the customer, even though you're paying them to provide this service.
Yeah.
So these are all also sort of aspects of inflation, because the less service that major companies provide to us for the price, the more of our time and energy has to get poured into ensuring that we get the thing that we paid for.
Totally.
And so I feel like this is all to say that I think we should be really thinking about how to create a metric that measures this. It's hard to measure because it's an amorphous thing. And that's what this article is about, how hard it is to measure these service, you know, decreases, how hard it is to measure sort of, you know, things, because especially because some people prefer not to interact with someone at a hotel front desk and some people don't. So like, it's hard to also measure what the customer experience is in a lot of these situations. But I think it would be worth us thinking about how we, especially when it comes to public services and government services, what kind of time investment and resource investment we expect of customers, and how that inflates. Because that has inflated dramatically. In the last 50 years, your ability to get health insurance has gotten much more complicated, even as it's gotten more expensive.
Totally.
We should be able to measure
that. And that, I think, goes to the point that we touched on a little bit last week as we were talking about means testing.
Yeah.
And that is a conversation that has been interesting, actually, because they asked, I saw an interview with Pramil Jayapal this week, and they asked her about means testing, and she talked specifically about how that just oftentimes creates some sort of new government bureaucracy that A, costs money, and B, sort of like makes it so hard for the people to get the assistance.
Right, onto the most needy cases.
There's a great piece on 60 Minutes last week about this program that had been set up ages ago for people who were in the armed services, who could get their college paid for or fully all of their debt paid for if they had paid sort of like 10 years on time, or I can't remember what the exact rules were, but essentially all of these people had done it, and then none of them were able to get their debt wiped because like there was a weird thing, and they were also had outsourced all of that to like private loan holders that were designed specifically to screw all of these people in the armed services over. So they had to like make a big deal. Like, that's the type of thing that, like, and they have had, of course, all spent, you know, probably by the time it was all said and done, hundreds of hours on the phone to, you know, so that's what you get with means testing, too. So what these things are all sort of intertwined with each other. That's the time tax, inflation, means testing.
The fact that we don't have a language or a way of discussing what this costs us is part of why we're still allowing a means testing conversation to happen.
Right.
Because if we understood, there's a program in California where you can get your ID for reduced price if you are low income. In order to prove you're low income, you have to go in person to a social services office and wait to have some form filled out for you, and then bring that in person to the DMV, which means your transportation costs almost inevitably will be higher than the cost difference between the regular cost ID and the low cost ID.
Yeah.
And also,
and that's California,
who wastes a ton of your time.
Prides themselves on.
Totally. It's one of the examples that's in that time tax article that was in The Atlantic I got this this term from. But the idea that time is not of any value, that time is invisible, and that there's no way to measure that, you know, that kind of bureaucratic cost on individual people who are almost always the neediest of people, is insane to me. And it also, I think because it's invisible, it happens in a lot more places and impedes service delivery in a lot more ways than we realize.
Yeah.
And so if you really want government programs to run efficiently, don't ask anyone for any information before you give them access to them. Honestly, that's the best way to get an efficiently run program.
Sure.
When they were just giving unemployment to whoever in the middle of the pandemic, that's when people were being best served by unemployment.
People got checks really easily sent to them.
Easily, and it made their lives easier, and that was the point of it.
Yeah.
I think when you think about, you know, how much work it is to apply to almost any government program because we insist on placing random caps on it that don't necessarily serve, you know, that don't serve the interests of the program. Obviously, some programs are meant for people who are living in poverty, and you have to have a way of figuring out who those people are that Jeff Bezos doesn't have access to that program. But like the systems that we use are designed to be so complicated and so foolproof that they're foolproof of themselves, and regular people who actually do qualify often can't get access to any of these programs. So in any case, I am interested in if there's a social scientist out there who wants to come up with a way of measuring the time tax, because I think it would be very useful. It would be useful for progressives, because I think an argument that, you know, when you're dealing with the kind of like corporatist Democrats who want to talk about fiscal responsibility and want to talk about paying, you know, for everything for 10 years or whatever, it would be useful if there were numbers that you could use to say, this is why this is not an efficient use of funds. This is why it is cheaper to just give people stuff. This, you know, whatever it is, like that would be a useful thing. So someone should do it. Is my point. Not me, because I don't know how to do that, but I gave you the idea for free. That was a free idea for me, you know?
Yeah, it was a good one.
In any case, school shootings are back.
Well, we're back to school.
So we're back. We're back in America. So,
there you go.
And that just reminds everyone that they can do some duck and cover drills so that they can be prepared to face other shootings like the one that happened today in a bar in St. Paul. So we're just giving people the life, giving students the life skills they'll need to live in America.
That's
where you can be shot anywhere. Yeah,
that's right.
So that's great news. Trump is still going on Fox News. Why are they consulting him about it? What does he have to do with anything?
I know.
It's so funny because one of the nice things about living in the Biden era is that if you are not a Republican, you never have to hear from Donald Trump. Like, I have not seen an interview with him, seen an image of him, seen anything from him in months.
Yeah.
And yet, if you go on to Fox News, it's just racist rants from Donald Trump. He had a real doozy this week. He went on a racist rant about, well, he's big into going on racist rants about Haitian migrants. He's decided now that they're bringing AIDS here.
Yeah.
As if, A, we didn't already have AIDS in America. I know. And B, as if AIDS is something that you can contract by just being in the vicinity of people.
He also said that there are hundreds of thousands of people flowing in from Haiti. So I think his... I think he's confused about some geography.
Where
he's
Haiti
got some,
is.
Yeah, he's got some geography confusion. Yeah,
there's, I feel concerned that I know more about AIDS than he does. He was the president for 4 years. Like, I know that he's not a genius, but I do feel like he had access to some information about just basic facts of immunology or whatever that I don't. And yet, I have a much firmer grasp on just... AIDS than he does.
And his rant was so crazy too. He said, so we have hundreds of thousands of people flowing in from Haiti. Haiti has a tremendous AIDS problem. AIDS is a step beyond. AIDS is a real bad problem. Many of those people will probably have AIDS, and they're coming into our country, and we don't do anything about it. We let everybody come in.
Well, no, we advertise HIV drugs to them all over media. I don't know if anyone's watched TV recently, but it's nothing but HIV drugs on every channel, every streaming platform.
Yeah.
I don't know if that is just because we live in West Hollywood. I don't know why that would be, but I am. That's the only kind of medication that gets advertised to me.
Yeah. Isn't this a man who also, didn't he say something to the effect of like his Vietnam was like not getting AIDS in the 80s or something like that? Or didn't he, isn't that right? So. Did I make that up?
Sounds familiar.
Stand by. This is my keyboard you're hearing.
We're hitting the Googles to find out about what Donald Trump's Vietnam was.
And somebody said that.
Yeah. I feel like, well, maybe it's weird if he said that because that would imply that he, in his understanding of the world, that implies he was having a lot of gay sex in the 80s.
So I don't know.
I don't know if that tracks for him.
I don't know.
In any case.
Yeah, he said something. Here, hold on. What did he say?
Oh, I'm excited to find out. I'm excited to hear Donald Trump's take on... He certainly went bankrupt in the
80s. Stern said something to him. Or he was on Howard Stern, obviously. He said, I even went as far to say that you're braver than any Vietnam vet because you're out there screwing a lot of women. They were talking about STDs. Mm. And then he said, yes, getting the Congressional Medal of Honor. Later in the interview, Trump and Stern again compared avoiding STDs to Vietnam.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bunch of upstanding citizens there.
So there you go.
Man, Donald Trump. Still a person who's alive. Now it's the return of Sinkhole Radio. This is not strictly a sinkhole story, but it's definitely in the frame of sinkhole radio. As you'll know, sinkhole radio has encompassed a few things that weren't sinkholes.
Also, I've got some sinkhole things to say if you'd like me to.
Yeah, no, I think that after we talk about the sinkhole radio story that we came here to bring you, Brent has a lot to say about sinkholes.
I've got a television review for you.
But I'll remind everyone that sinkhole radio has included in things such as tree snakes in the past. Plagues of locusts. So this is
sinkhole radio is a description of a type of story sometimes appears on this podcast.
Exactly.
That is not specific to sinkholes.
No, but it is about nature being terrifying. Right. So apparently in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, this morning, Sunday morning, when we were recording this, there was just like a loud, mysterious boom. It was heard over multiple states. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows what caused it. A lot of people hit the Googles looking for answers.
Sure.
No one found it. A few emergency service workers in various towns in New Hampshire also heard it themselves and were like, "Ooh, that's a bad boom." But no one knew what it was. A lot of people thought it might be an earthquake, but the National Earthquake Information Center said that they couldn't find any evidence of an earthquake in the area. So some people wondered if it was like a meteorite or like a plane crashed or something. And then my favorite fact about this story is that the New Hampshire Department of Safety said that their 911 call center only got one call about this. And the state police dispatch center got zero calls about this. But more than 400 people shared stories of hearing the boom on volcanodiscovery.com. What? Is everyone in New Hampshire just like trolling volcanodiscovery.com?
I don't know.
So that's a little weird.
Are there volcanoes there?
Also, the New Boston Space Force Station was also contacted for comment because somebody on Twitter discussed their experience that apparently... satellite tracking was transferred from the Air Force to the Space Force now or something. And the Space Force isn't real, so I don't know what that's about. But the Space Force did not reply to the story with a comment. So I wonder if the Space Force was up to something is my new theory, my working theory about what was going on with the boom in New Hampshire.
Yeah, sure.
Remember when during the pandemic in Philadelphia, people were just hearing loud explosions, but they weren't fireworks like everything else?
Yes.
And we were like, are they bombing Philadelphia? And no one ever figured out what it was. What's happening?
I don't know.
What causes a spontaneous loud boom?
I don't know. Aliens?
Aliens. Could be aliens. They're conspiracies here. Of various sorts.
Sure. The conspiracy boom.
The conspiracy boom. This is a true conspiracy boom.
Yeah, we're in one of those right now.
Exactly.
And we're boom times.
This is
conspiracies of all sorts.
This is also like a peak New Hampshire situation because probably the reason they have no idea what happened is because there's no government in New Hampshire.
No wonder they didn't call 911.
No, who would call 911 in New Hampshire? They're too busy living free.
Do they have that?
Exactly. If you're going to live that free, you don't necessarily think to alert the authorities when you hear a boom. They probably all went and investigated themselves, which is why they were all on VolcanoDiscovery.com sharing stories of the boom.
Probably.
If you're living that free, then, you know, you're dying hard. And so you gotta get out there and investigate on your own.
That's right.
That kind of libertarian freedom comes with a price. And that price is having to investigate spontaneous booms by yourself. So it's the most peak New Hampshire thing that's ever happened.
It really is.
Yeah. But you said you also have some sinkhole updates.
Well, that new show on NBC.
He watched La Brea.
I watched La Brea. I watched the first episode and it was the worst thing I ever saw. And then I 100% watched the second episode.
Obviously.
And we'll watch the third.
Sure.
Do you know the premise of the show?
Is it that Los Angeles gets swallowed by a giant sinkhole? Because that's what the promos made it look like.
Yes.
But I hear that there's more.
There's this important second part.
Yes.
Yes. The La Brea tar pits get sucked into a giant sinkhole.
Great.
And then people fall into the sinkhole.
As you
and
did.
And they fall into...
Happens to people all over the place.
They fall into a world...
Oh.
...that is potentially Los Angeles 10,000 years ago through the La Brea tar pits.
Okay.
So there's saber-toothed tigers...
No.
...down there. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So it's a fantasy show that begins with a sinkhole premise, but it's not...
And then people fall down
the
sinkhole.
There's no emergency.
And then
there's
like the Land Before Time down there, like at the center of the earth.
So this is a story that is not about sinkholes at all and uses a sinkhole as a premise to get a bunch of people into the La Brea tar pits.
Yeah.
So that they can live the Land Before Time. I had heard not what the second part of the premise was, but just that there were many premises involved in the premise of the show.
Yeah, it's trying very hard to be lost, right? Because
yes.
These people are in a place that they don't know where they are.
Right.
And there's all these different people who are now having to work with each other and various things. And then there's one of the women who's down there, her husband is up there and has been like seeing visions of like where she's at and things like that. So like he knows that she's alive. And
so
it's like there's a whole.
Does some of the story take place in an LA that just has a big hole in it?
Yeah.
And do new people fall into the sinkhole?
No.
Everyone
But the government is there trying to figure out what happened. But of course there's like, you know, these very sort of like high CIA people who like obviously know what's going on. Like they've known about these things that have been going on for a long, like they knew there were saber-tooth tigers in the
La Brea Tar Pits.
Yeah.
God, spies are so sneaky.
Yeah. It is really extraordinary. Like
it's a big swing.
It's a big swing. Yeah. And I love all of those cheesy fantasy shows. Like it reminds me very much of, and NBC has done them off and on before. They did that Manifesto, which I actually hated.
I don't get involved in any flight ones.
But it reminds me a lot of Surface, which was one of my favorite ones from
remember that.
Probably like 15 years ago, maybe, where it was like there were these like sea monsters. But again, it was sort of like, you know, like the government knew that there were these giant sea monsters.
And then they start, these shows always start
coming up shore and like, you know, it's like eating boats and things like that. And I'm like, this is that essentially. And I love it. And it's terrible. But like, that's my single
story. I feel like that show was intended to be such a big swing that everyone was like, well, I guess I have to watch it. What could this giant sinkhole show be about?
Oh, man.
I saw the promo and I was like, I don't need any more reminders
that
we could be swallowed
promo
by a sinkhole.
A lot during the Olympics.
Yes, exactly. I saw a lot of this. I dislike, there's two genres of promo that I dislike. One is that Showtime is currently showing a promo that involves a plane crash and I can't be involved in a plane.
No.
And it, for some reason, is glitching. So it shows multiple times before you can get to the show. It's just like torturing me. And then the second is anything where there's a giant natural disaster that you just watch the disaster part, but you don't find out about the fantasy, the mystical fantasy part. So it's just like a big emergency. All of LA is swallowed in a sinkhole. Yeah. And then it's just like, and that's it.
Right. You think it's like one of those like 911 shows.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Where it's like, now we have to get all these people out of a sinkhole. Mm-hmm. It's so it's not like the sinkhole in New York City that the guy got covered in rats. But in another sense, it's very similar because people are getting covered in saber-tooth tiger.
Right. Exactly. Yes.
Great. All right. You know, so keep us updated.
Oh, I will. Yeah. It's bad.
That's the news this week.
You know, it is.
Then you'll hear from us another time.
Next week.
Not next week. But on the 24th, we're going to have a special guest.
We have a guest.
So stay tuned for that. We will introduce her via social. So if you are curious, we'll tease it before the episode airs.
That's right.
But we're off next week, but we are going to be back with a guest and abandon.
Get excited.
The week after. So we'll talk to you then.
Bye.
Bye.